It's the Placebo Prayer edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, asthmatic placebos, prayer in school, pre-infected electronics, and drug research strategies. That and more. Let's start episode 124.
I'd like to start, if I may, with Professor Hawking. How did the universe start? With a big bang?
We observe that distant galaxies are moving away from us. They must have been closer together in the past. It was the beginning of the universe and of time itself. Anything that happened before the big bang could not affect what happened after.
Of the expanding universe, the poetry of the complexity of life. We're not normally equipped to understand, but science gives it to us. Science is opening your eyes to the wonderfulness of what's there. Science is opening your eyes to the poetry of the expanding universe.
To come to you, Carl Sagan, could you help me by putting into layman's terms what was involved?
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
I'm Jenna, your biochemist.
You know, this week, you know, it was a sad week. It marked the end of the space shuttle, you know, the end of American space involvement to a certain degree, you know, talk about the unfunding of the James Webb telescope and all that. But some of us managed to go into outer space in their own unique little way. Ethan, I understand that you went to TAM-9 from outer space.
That's right, Don, I did.
And did you explore the Skeptiverse?
I explored the Skeptiverse, I traversed the humanist landscape, and I delved into the atheist cave.
Nebulous.
Sure.
Nebula.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. In fact, I had a fantastic time at TAM-9 in Las Vegas. You know, it was an exhausting, but at the same time, exhilarating experience. I met a ton of great people. And I returned home.
No.
Yeah, I did. Returned home. I was sort of in that kind of half awake, half comatose state. And I got in. I sat down at my computer, started uploading my pictures onto Facebook and chatting with a few people. And I noticed that my floor was moving. And no, I wasn't exhausted. There was some new tenants living in my apartment. I have an ant infestation.
Wow. So you must have been absolutely overjoyed that you, in your own little way, have joined in the back to nature movement by creating an entirely new ecosystem in your kitchen with these ants. Did it make you happy and overjoyed to find these new natural residents?
I killed them.
Oh.
I sprayed toxic gas on them.
They're an invasive species. Come on.
Oh, okay.
And they're weird ants, too.
That's his habitat.
Wait, but and Ethan isn't an invasive species?
It's not in my home. But nevertheless, back from TAM, I have a TAM report. I did record a number of great interviews with some of the speakers. Unfortunately, between lack of sleep and killing ants, I haven't had time to prepare them yet, but stay tuned for the next coming episodes. We do have some great guests, including Richard Wiseman, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Elizabeth Loftus, and more. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, I would like to tell you guys a little bit about what you missed at the amazing meeting.
Was it like a record-breaking heat wave, you know, for all those climate change deniers?
We missed sweat.
Well, I don't know. I wasn't outside. I was inside a nice air-conditioned hotel. Actually, the air conditioning was far too intense. Many times I felt like I was drying out like a prune. That's what happens when you get recycled air. And did you know that they still can smoke inside casinos?
Really?
Yes.
Well, it makes sense if you think about it. I mean, it is all part of that gambling ethos, right? So, I mean, if you're going to gamble with money, why not gamble with your life?
Mm.
And, you know, often they're pumping in oxygen, so you might as well get some carbon dioxide there, too, to balance out the whole equation.
Right. Well, for listeners who don't know what the hell we're talking about, TAM is the amazing meeting, which is sponsored by the James Randi Educational Foundation and happens every year in Las Vegas. They've also had one in London and Sydney. TAM is the largest skeptical conference in the world, this year drawing over 1,600 people. It was just an amazing event. I'm still sort of digesting what I've learned over the weekend. I got great interviews. I met some really cool people, some skeptical heroes of mine. And, you know, it's funny. I didn't realize that staying up till 3 a.m. drinking with several pubs worth of skeptics would adversely impact my productivity, but it kind of did. Some of my thoughts on the talks and the panels won't be complete because I'm still digesting it all. The JREF is actually going to be putting these videos online, freely available to everyone. I do encourage you to check them out. Don't just take my word for it. They are, in fact, great. My second TAM, TAM 8, last year I went. A lot of nice people. Had a really, really good time. This year was much better. I got to catch up with people that I've met at TAM, at other skeptical conferences. Lots of new people, made some new friends, made some new connections. It's sort of like a big family reunion, actually. If you can imagine that, with skeptics.
Without the creepy uncle.
Well, there's the odd creepy person there, too. So, you know, you're walking around, shaking hands, meeting new people. It's also kind of like a family reunion in the sense that there's lots of gossip going on. And it's kind of interesting because you'll be sitting with people and you'll be chatting about, you know, who's who and what they're doing. There's a wide range on gossip, people complaining or joking or debating, discussion of, you know, oh, this person isn't doing it right and, you know, this person is, you know, doing bad things. So it's kind of interesting. We like to assume that skeptics are exceptionally rational people, which is not true. We can be just as silly and occasionally petty as any other group. So it's always fun to dive into that aspect of it as well.
So okay, let's speed up. Give us some good gossip. Give us some good gossip. You met friends, great. We love your friends. Gossip.
Yeah, I'm not going to dive into the gossip because some people have entrusted their confidence in me, and if I were to go out there and reveal, for instance, that James Randi is a big fan of Don's, that would violate James Randi's trust. But talk about some of the actual activities. The first sort of day was made up of optional workshops, and these are a lot of sort of skeptical activism training sessions designed to sort of, for people like us, actually. I only attended a few this year. A lot of it's sort of old hat material from here, but I really did enjoy the UFO workshop where Jim Underdown, who's the executive director of CFI Los Angeles, showed us how to fake UFO pictures by tying a coffee machine lid to an invisible string on the end of a big pole, and then you take pictures with it, and it looks like there's a UFO in the background of whatever picture you're taking. So I'm going to try this and make some fake UFO pictures.
You do know there's this new thing called Photoshop that sort of makes it all...
We talked about Photoshop, actually. We went in-depth into how Photoshop works. And in fact, I found out that Photoshop is going to be replaced soon by a new program from Adobe. They showed us how you can actually scan JPEGs to determine if they've been tampered with by a Photoshop. So really, actually, a very fascinating workshop. The other one that I went to was a grassroots one. This was presented by Desiree Schell, who fans know is the host of our Comrades Skeptically Speaking podcast. Des is a union organizer. This is what she does for a living. So she gave us a lot of information that skeptics don't seem to know about how to craft a message. And she did this by showing how unions will organize their campaigns. They don't just try to get, you know, general awareness. They have goals, objectives, they have tactics, and they have a target audience. And it's very scientific and it's very direct. You know, skeptics, sometimes we just kind of want to go out there and say, hey, we exist, and hope that people will follow up on us. But they obviously don't.
As someone who's new to the skeptical community and who has recently sort of approached the types of message being put out by that community, I'm really glad to hear it because it is something that the skeptic community has to be aware of, is not just talking to like-minded people, but who they're trying to attract to become part of their community and how to communicate with people who aren't necessarily initiated in the type of language that's already used in the circles.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in addition to that, Des created an actual booklet of do's and don'ts, suggestion, advice, strategies. I was really impressed with it. I'm definitely going to be studying that. And I do hope that, you know, CFI and other skeptical groups really take this to heart because this is something that we're kind of missing in our community. We're not trained activists, but we like to be activists.
Is there a PDF version or anything that we can access?
I'm not aware of one, but I'm sure that's something that they're thinking of, and I will get in touch with Des about that for sure. So the talks began the day after the workshops. I'm going to kind of power through this really briefly. The first person to, well, actually the first group of people to come out was the SGU, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, did a couple live shows, which was very entertaining, followed by Michael Shermer, who is, of course, the president of the Skeptic Society. He discussed his new book, The Believing Brain, and also discussed his recent appearance on the Colbert Report, which was quite good if anyone saw it, followed by a panel on skepticism on TV, discussing some of the past skeptically themed TV shows as well as what we want to see in the future out of television. I had to do some interviews at that point, so I missed a few talks, but I came back in time to see Project Alpha Retrospective. Now, this was something that James Randi organized many years ago. He had two magicians infiltrate a laboratory that was trying to scientifically investigate psychic powers. Now, if you've heard of Project Alpha, you know that what they investigated was a group of magicians conning these guys. These scientists checked their skepticism at the door, and these magicians ran circles around them. It's quite a famous study, and there's actually a book coming out about it, and that was a really fantastic discussion. Probably the best event of the whole conference was a panel on Our Future in Space, which was featured Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, Pamela Gay, Phil Plait, and Lawrence Krauss. Now, seriously, you have to watch this when it's posted. It is amazing. It becomes quite a heated debate, especially between Tyson and Krauss, and Tyson kept taking his microphone and sort of slamming it on the table for emphasis when he said things, which he doesn't really need to do because he has got so much gravitas on his own, but it was quite exciting. After the panel, Tyson gave his keynote address, which was also very interesting. He talked about the ways that America is falling behind in science and critical thinking. He showed a lot of examples from popular culture, from politics, and even science institutions that were actually embarrassingly getting basic science wrong. The neat thing was he was running out of time, so he asked everybody if he wanted to finish up and just go have dinner, but everybody said no, and they cheered him on, and he kept going for another 20 minutes, which was pretty cool because he's awesome. Later that night, we had the SU dinner party, which was great. Then later in the evening was Penn Jillette's bacon and donut party, which was indescribable. And I can't describe it. You should have been there.
Okay.
After that, we had the next day of the conference, and we had Sadie Crabtree, who's one of the conference organizers, and she talked about how to craft a message to the public about skepticism. Some of the important points that she made was that the average person isn't a skeptic. They don't know what critical thinking is. They don't know the basics of science, and they don't know our terminology, which actually kind of gets back to our debate on jargon. So, Sadie made some really interesting points along the lines of the whole tone argument, which has been sort of on the minds of everybody for the past 2 or 3 years. We came up with the science-based medicine panel, which was moderated by Stephen Novella, and we're going to actually discuss this a bit later on in the show. Following that was Elizabeth Loftus, and I'm not going to tell you too much about her because we're going to hear from her in the coming weeks on the show. She was one of the interviews that we did. But briefly, she discussed manufacturing memories. She was the one who developed the Lost in the Mall technique, and you're going to hear about that later on the show. Later on, we had Richard Wiseman, who gave a fantastic talk, lots of energy and humor, showed us some very interesting visual illusions and some neat audio ones. He discussed his new book, Paranormality, and again, we'll hear from Richard later in the show in the coming week, so not to go into too much detail. We had a talk by Carol Travis, who is the author of Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, and she gave a really interesting talk on the psychology of convincing people, which again fits into the whole tone argument. She discussed the sort of pyramid of rationalization. You have two people who potentially could cheat on their exams. One person decides not to cheat, one person decides to cheat, and they both rationalize their decision as more time passes until eventually they decide, you know what, I always would have cheated on my exam, I always never would have cheated on my exam, and their opinions become so entrenched that they now view each other as, you know, the scum of the earth. It's a really interesting way of looking at how, you know, the skeptical community can interface, debate, and you know, discuss things with the non-skeptical community, and just how you know, polarized the debate can easily become, thanks to psychology. And then we had Bill Nye, the science guy, my skeptical hero, give a talk on his past, how he got into science.
Jenna, sorry, how many heroes has he had so far?
I have many heroes.
I've got to count up to 87.
And didn't we have something on our last show about how hero worship is sort of bad? I mean, I think you did a whole thing about heroification. Not a real word, but...
As a skeptic, they are my heroes, but I recognize they are human beings. So I'm not like that.
I've seen your shrine tonight.
Yeah. Well, whatever. He's cool. He talked about the major problems we're facing in the world, like climate change. He talked about space exploration. He had a really nice part of his presentation about Carl Sagan. Bill Nye was a student of his. They communicated often. Carl Sagan was actually scheduled to appear on his TV show. Unfortunately, he passed away before that could happen, which was sad to hear. Up next came Richard Dawkins, who gave a talk on his new book, which is a children's book about the magic of reality. He gave a preview showing some of the artwork. It's basically laid out as starting with a myth, followed by what does the science say about this myth? Everything from creation to alternative medicine, et cetera, et cetera. The artwork was actually rather, rather exciting. It was really neat. I haven't seen anything quite like that before. He kind of turned the conversation into a discussion on evolution from the point of view of aliens and what processes would aliens go through in their evolution, would they follow Darwinian evolution, et cetera, et cetera. Got a little complicated at this point. I think probably went over my head and any of the heads of people who weren't biologists. And let's face
biology.
It, Dawkins is a bit of a dry speaker.
For us, Jenna, of course, would have been probably on the edge.
Yeah, Jenna probably would have loved
going.
It.
You have to tell us. So does this justification of his soporific tone mean that you might have become a little sleepy during his talk?
I was a little,
pretty complicated, yeah. Hard to follow with your eyes closed.
The one thing that Dawkins did say, and he actually got a standing ovation for this, was that he announced the Richard Dawkins Foundation would be sponsoring daycare at skeptical conferences all over. So that means that places like TAM and anything else will now have a funded daycare. So that was a nice gesture on his part. The final talks of the day, we saw Susanna Martinez-Conde and Stephen Macnick. And again, I'm not going to go into too much detail because we're going to hear from them in the coming weeks. They discussed magic from the point of view of neurobiology. I also got to see Sarah Mayhew, and actually Sarah's a fellow blogger on Skeptic North. She gave a talk on secular storytelling, and I always find it fun to meet people that I know and correspond with online, but I've never actually seen their face, so that was fun. The other really great event that I was really impressed by was the panel on communicating skepticism, which featured P.Z. Myers, Eugenie Scott, Carol Travis, Jimmy Ian Swiss, and Phil Plait. This was the whole panel debating the should we be dicks thing. I'm actually still kind of thinking this one over, so I haven't quite made up my mind. But I think...
Sorry. I'm offended by that term. You're implying somehow that males are not good because you used the D word.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant to say.
You could have used the C word, and that would have been...
So much better,
maybe,
right?
Maybe we need a hybrid word. Equally offensive to both sexes.
Yes.
Sure, okay. We'll use that. I was fairly impressed with what P.Z. Myers said, which is not all that surprising since I usually agree with P.Z. Myers on this particular point. And since we're getting all tired and sleepy, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. I have more to tell you about TAM after
no
this.
No more slides.
Quiet you.
Well, how best to explain it? You've seen me in X-Men.
Yeah.
The character I am, Professor Charles Xavier. Mm. If you remember, he can control things with the power of his mind, can make people do things and see things. So I thought, what if you can do that for real? I mean, not in a comic book world, but in the real world.
All right.
So in my film, I play a man who controls the world with his mind.
Right. That's interesting.
Yeah, for instance, I'm walking along, and I see this beautiful girl, and I think I'd like to see her naked, and so all her clothes fall off.
All her clothes fall off?
Yes, and she's scrabbling around to get them back on again, but even before she can get her knickers on, I've seen everything. You know, I've seen it all.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. We've already seen everything.
Okay. It's a comedy, is it?
No.
You first learned about the birds and the bees? Want to learn more about the birds and the bees and the berries, urban agriculture, delicious homegrown food, solar energy, and much more?
On the remote!
Check out the Society Promoting Environmental Conservation. Come to one of our workshops, join our solar panel tour, or go to our website, www.spec.bc.ca, for more information.
And we're back with Slide Carousel 483. Ethan, tell us more about your TAM visit.
I will, Don. Thank you for asking. What a nice fellow. So the next talk that came up was by Stephen Novella, host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. And he actually did a new talk that I've never heard him give before. And it was, in fact, on a different issue than his usual brand of, you know, pseudoscience is bad. He talked about mental illness denial. So he discussed a bit about Scientology, a bit about the doubts about ADHD, medicating mental illnesses. And he actually made a very interesting point that if you doubt the existence of mental disorders, you know, like ADHD, logically you'd also have to doubt the existence of migraine headaches, as there is about the same amount of scientific evidence for both of them. And very few people doubt that migraine headaches exist. So he also kind of went into sort of the history of denialism about mental illness, some psychiatrists who have denied its existence. He talked a bit about sort of the pushback against sort of big pharma that medicates people. And it was a pretty unique take on things that I hadn't considered before. And now on to the predictably most controversial panel at TAM this year, which was the panel on diversity in the skeptical community, featuring Greta Kashina, DJ Grothy, Debbie Goddard, Jamila B., and Hemant Mehant, moderated by Desiree Schell. All I can really say about this panel is that I agreed with Debbie, Greta, and Jamila, but I couldn't understand what Hemant's position was. And as soon as DJ started talking about how skepticism can only be applied to science and not the, quote, soft sciences, which are the social sciences, I had major problems with his argument. And that's not really a surprise considering my background. Now, in addition to this, when I was at the pub afterwards, I was talking to one group of people who I know, I respect, I like, etc. And I was listening to how angry and disappointed they were at the panel on diversity. They were particularly angry with DJ's argument. They were angry with how the panel was conducted. Later on in the evening, I was sitting with another group of people that I know, I like, I respect, etc. And I was floored by how much they supported the position of DJ and how much they didn't like the position of Greta and Debbie and how they thought the panel was a waste of time.
Not that I want to make this longer, but for those listeners out there, what are their positions?
Well, Greta, Debbie, etc., they were arguing that in order to decrease the diversity of skepticism, we have to stop talking about Bigfoot, UFOs, and alternative medicine all the time. We need to vary our mandate, which I think we would support because, hell, our show is that mandate.
That's the entire purpose of our things.
And DJ was sort of taking the position that, well, you know, the gay rights activist movement and the other sort of social causes that we were talking about are natural allies of the skeptical movement, and they may be humanist causes. That is not the domain of skepticism. The domain of skepticism is scientifically testable claims, which these things are not. And he was also sort of lumping in with that claims about historical claims, social sciences, sociology, that sort of thing, suggesting that that's not something that we as skeptics can logically address. I thought they were debating things at a cross purpose. I think DJ was kind of coming to the point of view that this was not suitable material for a TAM, but I don't think they were suggesting that they have TAM 10 be all about the social sciences. I think that the position was more focused on sort of grassroots groups, local skeptical organizations, how they can branch out and get people who don't really care about Bigfoot and UFOs. So that was kind of the nature of the conversation. Later on in the evening, I got to talk to DJ himself, and I heard more thoughts on the matter, and I gave me some, I think, clarity on his point. So I disagreed, but I wasn't angry with him about it. But, I mean, the surprising aspect was the way that I saw this sort of radical disposition of some of the people and some of the groups that I was chatting with. And it really kind of made me think how, you know, we can see these talks and how our own individual backgrounds, our ideologies, our experiences will shape the way we view the material. The fact that, you know, these two groups of people who saw the same talk walk away with radically different interpretations of what they saw really made me think. So the last two talks of TAM belong to Jennifer Ouellette, who's going to be a guest on the show later. I won't go too much into detail, except to say that she played a clip from Doctor Who in her talk, which was awesome. Finally, we had Sean Faircloth, who gave a political talk about his organization, the Secular Coalition for America, which was interesting. Personally, I felt he manipulated the audience a little bit. He sounded like a politician, trying to push buttons. Had not much of an impact on me as a Canadian. All his talk was America, 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 how great they were. So, despite the minor points, TAM 9, big success, quite fun, and I look forward to the interviews later in the show.
That was fascinating, Ethan, and perhaps we'll conclude the TAM review and return to Radio Free Thinker in progress after these commercials.
Don, I agree with you 100%.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR, and we have a 20-minute field recording of a tumluku, which is a Bosnian instrument which can only be played when you have a pierced scrotum and three kids who have been killed by a landmine. It's unlistenable radio! You understand me?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Totally listenable radio.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back. So, I have a bit here to do about why schools remain religious-free zones. I found a couple of articles in the last week or two about prayer and in schools. So I'm going to read a couple of them, and then we'll do maybe a bit of thoughts about them. One, which I thought was interesting, is kind of a reversal of some things we've talked about. Muslim group calls for freedom of worship in mission schools. The Coalition of Muslim Organizations in Ghana has expressed concern about the issues of not allowing Muslim children in Christian mission schools to openly practice their religion. The coalition says that the practice did not only deny them the full ability to practice their faith, but also violated their constitutional rights. Which leads to a very interesting thing, is that when you have a religious school, I mean, if a Catholic school sets up a mission school in a country, we kind of say, well, it's their school and they should be able to allow to do it. But at what point does the idea of one's freedom to education, one's right to education, be circumvented by a school's right to teach religion? In an almost a reversal of that particular point of view, here in Canada, a Muslim group wants to halt services in school. One of Canada's largest Muslim groups has denounced worship by students in a North York middle school, claiming it has opened a Pandora's box of issues and should be stopped. The Muslim Canadian Congress has joined other groups like the Canadian Hindu Advocacy and the Jewish Defense League and are calling for an end of prayer in prayer services in school cafeterias. Apparently in North York and among other schools in Toronto District, they are allowing Christian prayer to occur on school property during cafeteria times. Of course, this all started when one of our avid listeners pointed out an article to me about prayer in Manitoba schools. Apparently, according to a recent article in the Winnipeg Free Press, my beloved birth province of Manitoba has slipped into the dark ages since I have left its fine soil. I remember in early elementary school every morning having to sing O Canada, God Save the Queen, and recite the Lord's Prayer. I don't remember having to continue this after grades 4 or 5, and I thought the practice long consigned to the refuse bin of history. However, it seems that in a number of classrooms, even over the school's PA system, the Lord's Prayer is now commonplace in a number of communities in Manitoba. Now, unlike the U.S., there is no constitutional separation of church and state in Canada, largely thanks to the fact that, in theoretical sense, the Queen is also the head of the Anglican Church, and us being a British colony, that made separation of church and state also a treasonable offense. But the fact is that up until the landmark Supreme Court case in 1992, students could actually be punished or expelled for not standing or reciting the Lord's Prayer in Canadian schools. Now, according to the Public School Act in Manitoba, if 60 to 75% of parents sign a petition, prayer services in a denomination stated on the petition may actually be conducted on the school property outside of instructional times. Now, you know, this seems like a really good compromise, you know, between what sort of the official stance is and what people, the religious people, might like. It also states that schools may not solicit ballots or ask the community for it. It must be actually a grassroots driven thing. It has to come from that, and that teachers and students must be completely free to withdraw from that. However, apparently, even with these really liberal sort of open sort of conditions, they're not even being followed. That according to some Freedom of Information request made by an attentive atheist in Dauphin, Manitoba, over half of the school divisions in Manitoba violate these simple rules. And they do it in rather non-evil ways, but are pernicious by sending out ballots to students and to parents saying, hey, do you want us to have prayers in schools? And they're soliciting it, which is not what they're supposed to be doing. Now, in small communities, people who are non-religious or those of a non-standard religion are quite often forced via peer pressure to participate in these anti-educational practices. By providing space, time, and often personnel, school boards are subsidizing the indoctrination of innocent children into something they deny them the very tools to understand. I mean, they have prayer in kindergarten, but they wait until high school or university before they give them the logical or scientific tools to assess this sort of propaganda. It just seems really backwards to me. I had a really lively discussion with someone recently over the supposed risks of exposing children to Wi-Fi signals in school. This they get upset about, but they sit back and they do little or nothing about the intellectual cancers infecting our school's educational system. Education is not only the foundation of young lives, but the future of the country. If we continue to allow this rot at its core, what hope have we got for the future? I mean, seriously, this is a huge issue, and it really gets quite annoying that we create this special space for religion in an institution that is the supreme foundation of any society is education. But then I might be ranting. What are your guys' thoughts?
I do know that CFI Canada and the Canadian Secular Alliance have taken very strong positions on the Muslim prayers being taught in Toronto. I haven't heard if they've responded to the situation in Manitoba just yet, but that seems like it'd be on their mandate as well. Do you know if the students in Manitoba who do opt out of prayer, do they face academic consequences?
It's not an academic consequence. And part of it, and I think it's hard for some people in a place like Vancouver to quite realize that in a lot of these communities are maybe 2,000, 3,000 people, and everybody knows everyone. And if you wanted to be that one person to not participate, that makes you literally a pariah in your own community. And you're just not going to stand out there. People just don't do that sort of thing in small towns. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the school seems to be actively canvassing, and I'm sure it's by principals or teachers who have a sort of agenda to promote what they think is a good thing, which is why they're going out into the community and saying, hey, we'd like to have prayer in the schools. Do you agree? Why it's happening, and not maybe necessarily realizing the social damage that they've been doing to the children. And two, just the whole idea that we allow this. I mean, if this was a racist message, we wouldn't have a vote to allow people to it, right? Mm-hmm. And yet we seem to, again, create this special space for religion.
And it also seems to me that the problem of, or the sort of presence of a religious construct in schools is also a bigger issue than we might even recognize. So it really reminds me when you're talking about, you know, people being a pariah in a small town. I grew up in a small town, and there were a few kids who were Jehovah's Witness who went home or to the library or to do different things if we were going to color Easter eggs or have a Christmas party and that kind of thing that is incredibly pervasive in all schools. But of course, has a profoundly religious basis. And so again, I always come back down to what lines do we as a society want to draw?
My question is there something wrong with the churches they already have in Manitoba? Are they like crumbling to the ground? Have they been burnt to the ground by rabid atheists? Is there some reason they have to pick the schools to hold these?
Yes, there is. But you're not going to like this answer, because I admit it smacks a slight of conspiracy, but it's one that the Inquisition has been going for a lot of years, is that if you can get children at a young age and repeat a particular message over and over, they become brainwashed into that. So if every day a 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old does the Lord's Prayer, it becomes a part of their identity, a part of their psyche, and you get that into them. So if you only do it on Sundays, and only those children whose parents take them to church, which is a declining number in our society, they are losing out on all these potential people that they can have in their flock.
Well, or the messages that the parents want to teach and be supporting these type of programs. And I could think of it almost like a language immersion school, where you don't want to just have a certain language education at home, but to have that continued through the school hours to make sure, again, that fluency in that language is there. And this type of program would ensure fluency in a religious language.
No. See, I would disagree with it, because I agree me and Jenna disagree. it's not quite the same, because, I mean, one, you know, you're using the language on a consistent and constant basis to maintain it in there, and that's great. But as Ethan kind of pointed out, you can have prayer in your family before you take them to school. You can have prayer after they come home from school. The fact that you're doing it in an institution, an educational institution, is the part that I think has the big issue, irrespective of whether the parent may wish for them to be indoctrinated in it or not.
Yeah, no, I was just trying to explore the possible motivations, not advocating for one or the other.
No, I yes. Parent, yeah, well.
In any case.
Poor Don, he's just fuming.
Yes. But no, it's again, too, the idea is that we have to have this particular view. We don't have to have this particular view, but it seems to be logical to have this particular view. As educational institutions being the area where we learn about the way the real world works. That doesn't mean it's the only place, right? I mean, there are certain places where family values get learned in the household, and that's where you learn it, and that's not necessarily something that maybe this education system should provide. But things like the scientific method, I mean, it may seem ridiculous in one level, but if we're willing to teach kids about Jesus and the Holy Ghost and all that in the kindergarten, why don't we also teach them about the scientific method? Why don't we also talk about logical fallacies? Why do we wait and not give them those tools until they're in university, and yet feel completely okay at providing them with this mythical fairy story that not only damages them as far as how they look at the world, but I mean, again, think of how violent it is when you tell a little kid that if you don't do X, Y, or Z, you are going to burn forever in hell. I mean, that is a horrible thing to expose a child to.
Don, you're ranting.
Okay.
Well, Jenna, so what have you got for us this week?
Well, I came across a story that apparently was also discussed at length at one of the panels in TAM that has to do with the placebo effect and exploring those ideas. So in most studies, you're going to use the placebo as a tool to investigate the action of a potential drug. Well, in this study, the researchers turned that around and used a drug that's already in use.
Yeah.
Thank you, an approved drug, and used that as well as a no intervention control to investigate the effect of the placebo.
So, just for those people who are out there, how are we defining the term placebo in this context?
So a placebo is supposed to be something that's basically not supposed to have an effect, but it's disguised as a real treatment such that people think that they're receiving a real treatment. So this is often called sort of the sugar pill. So, and a so-called placebo effect is when there appears to be a benefit to the patient from taking the placebo. So although, like I said, placebos have usually been used as tools, again, to evaluate drugs, this study did it the other way around. So in this particular study, the researchers compared the short-term effects of 4 intervention strategies on asthma symptoms. And the 4 conditions they tested were an buterol bronchodilator inhaler, and this is a treatment currently in use, and this was used as the positive control in this study. And then as one of the placebos, they used an inhaler with no active ingredient that wasn't expected to have any physiological effect. And then they used a second placebo, which was, quote, validated sham acupuncture, which I can only assume to mean take a needle and stick it in them anywhere.
Well, I'll elaborate on that. Sham acupuncture is designed to look like real acupuncture. Acupuncture actually has a code of how you're supposed to do it. There's certain meridians and pressure points you're supposed to put the needles. Sham acupuncture just puts them in anywhere. But they don't tell you.
So my interpretation was correct.
Yeah, they don't tell you that this isn't quote-unquote real acupuncture. It's kind of like a gotcha test where they say, oh, you thought that acupuncture really worked? Well, guess what? We were just sticking them in at random. Bah!
So what do they do? When they have the accreditation process for acupuncture, they take all the people who failed the test and say, we want you to be part of this particular study.
Okay, Don, you've had your rant for today. So the fourth condition that they used in this test, again, was a no intervention control, a negative control, which is basically, okay, just sit there for a minute. So the results were measured in two ways. So this is by a standardized physiological measurement of the amount of air that the patient was able to expel in 1 second, the maximum amount of air they could exhale, and also by a subjective measurement that was self-reported when the patients were asked to rate their symptom improvement from 0 to 10. So basically separating it into an objective measurement done by the researchers and a subjective measurement that was reported by the patients. So what these researchers found is that the people were really bad at telling whether or not they were receiving a real treatment, which is not, you know, that's sort of what you're expecting in a clinical study. You don't want them to know whether or not they're receiving something. Of course, this was not true for the no intervention control when they were told to just sit there. However, they were also really, really bad at evaluating their own symptoms. So basically, the subjective or the objective qualitative test of the air volume showed pretty much what was expected. So the genuine inhaler induced a 20% increase in lung function, while the two placebos and the no intervention controlled had the same results, and they showed about a 7% increase in function. So that is to say that there was a difference between the placebos and the genuine treatment, but no difference between the treatment, the placebos and no treatment at all.
So I was confused when I was reading over your notes. So with the people who actually got real medicine, mm-hmm. had a 20% improvement.
Correct.
Those people who got no treatment had a 7% improvement.
Correct. So the way that this was measured was over a two-hour period, they were asked to complete this test at 20-minute intervals. So just the act of being in the office in that calm environment, as well as repeatedly doing this, you know, forced expulsion of air, did increase the quality of the lung function, which is why this group is advocating the no intervention control. Because if you didn't have that control, you might think that the placebo itself was inducing this 7% increase. But really, by having a no intervention control, you're able to tease out whether or not there's an actual physiological effect of the placebo or whether it has to do with the environmental conditions.
That's smart.
Definitely. So that was the objective condition, the objective test. We were able to tell the difference between placebo and real treatment, but no difference between placebo and no treatment. However, in the subjective, so this is the patient-reported scores, there's a completely different story. In this case, the patients who were receiving any kind of treatment, so genuine or completely fake, reported about the same amount of improvement, while patients getting no treatment reported less improvement because they were just sitting there. So this is to say that patients couldn't distinguish the alterations in their own symptoms after treatment with real meds, completely fake acupuncture, or fake meds, even though there was a significant measurable difference happening at the same time. So it's also worth noting that this effect was found to be equal for both the fake medication and the fake acupuncture. So there didn't seem to be a significant psychological effect between those two types of intervention. So the researchers basically concluded that the patient reports in asthma are unreliable and that appropriate objective measurements should be used. And as we talked about, they also mentioned that a no intervention is really useful because you're able to evaluate the reliability of the actual placebos and tell whether or not it's physiological or psychological.
And at the science-based medicine panel where they brought this study up, they were suggesting how a lot of sort of alternative health proponents were trying to use this to suggest that, look, patients state that, you know, acupuncture works just as well as science-based medicine, even though they don't seem to understand that the study says no, it doesn't.
Well, not only does it say no, it doesn't, but it says certified sham acupuncture.
Yes, which is kind of weird that they're that silly. When Stephen Novella was talking about this, he made a point to keep flipping back between his two slides, one showing the actual objective results, then the self-reported. See, he kept flipping it back and forth, saying, see, kind of went a bit too on with that, until someone, I think Harriet Hull, told him to stop. But the point being made
that... That would have been me if I was in that room.
Yeah, the point being made that people are extremely bad at, as you said, detecting their own results of this medication, and that our psychology is extremely powerful when we're getting any kind of treatment. Even, as you said, just sitting in a doctor's office, I'm sure it was very clean and nice. And
Attention
from the nice nurses, that itself had an effect on people.
Well, and that was actually one of the major critiques of this study from some other researchers, is that, first off, even the objective tests were done under conditions that were not inducive to asthma, inducive being a word I may or may not have just made up. But basically, that it was not stressing the lungs in a way that would induce asthma symptoms. So it wasn't a really good test of the asthma itself. And also that these patients appear to have fairly poorly controlled asthma, which in and of itself might mean that they're not very good at being able to evaluate their own symptoms. And the way that they selected patients for that study to be able to see the physiologic results, that was sort of a necessary component of that. However, there's also people that object not only to the way that the study was performed, but to the actual conclusions. So Dr. Daniel Moorman had a review of this article that was also printed in the same journal, which is the New England Journal of Medicine, I believe. And he asked, what is more important outcome in medicine, the objective or the subjective, the doctor's or the patient's perception? So he goes on to argue that in subjective symptom-driven diseases, such as migraines and irritable bowel disorder, back pain, asthma, etc., that the subjective outcomes that are actually evaluated by the patients themselves should necessarily trump the objective measurements used by the medical professional, as the patient is the one coping with the conditions. So based on this argument, he sort of makes the case that a safe placebo can be as effective in patient outcomes as a quote-unquote real treatment in the eyes of the patient. However, this point of view has its own critics in those medical professionals who feel that although the placebo may do no harm, which is often touted as the first goal in medical intervention, that the disingenuous nature of knowingly administering phony treatment flies in the face of medical ethics as we know it.
I would kind of suggest that Dr. Moorman is sort of creating a straw man version of this, that it's either the doctor's point of view or it's the patient's point of view. I think that's probably more a false dichotomy, actually. But the point being is that's not the only two alternatives here. The doctor is trying to find the best result for the patient. And the discussion came up as well, like, what would the doctors on the panel think about prescribing a placebo? And for vague pain symptoms, if that's what works for the patient, they're willing to consider that. They don't like it. They consider it a case-by-case decision. They also mentioned that there's been times when they've had family come in and say, listen, we don't want you to tell our brother or sister or whatever that you're giving them a placebo. We want them to think they're getting the real medicine.
Well, or else the placebo's pretty much useless.
Exactly, right? So there are certain ethical quandaries with such a situation.
Well, and I think, too, another aspect here, and I don't know, again, I'm going to create another straw man, perhaps, is that if you suffer from back pain and you ignore medicine that will actually loosen the muscles or what have you because the patient doesn't subjectively think it does any good, well, that would strike me as something that would be wrong to do, that if the patient subjectively doesn't understand that their body may be suffering less, but for one reason or another, isn't that where you bring in like the psychologist or whatever to help them say, well, I know this is what you perceive, but to a certain degree, what you're perceiving does not coalesce or coincide with the reality of it. I mean, I know pain can be a very dicey area, but at least in a lot of these cases, I don't think it should be the doctor per se who would be supplying the subjective medicine, but it'd be someone more like a psychologist or someone in that area where you're addressing what seems to be the real problem is the disconnect.
You know, I think kind of going along with Don's point there, the whole point of the study was to show that subjective evaluations aren't that reliable. I mean, if I walked into a doctor and said, "Doctor, my foot hurts, give me morphine," you know, like I think a sensible doctor is going to say, "No, let's have an X-ray first." You know,
I got a better one. Doctor, my foot hurts. Could you please amputate my arm to cure it?
Okay, no. That's an interesting take on that. But the point being is, shouldn't a doctor who has the experience, the background, given some benefit of the doubt?
And actually, you know, this points up to one of the complaints, and maybe slightly justified complaints, of the alternative medicine type people, is that we do tend to sort of narrow down the scope of what happens, is that, you know, the doctor does one thing and that's the only person you should see, where these things may be more complicated and need to be seen more as a systemic thing. Whereas, you know, you see the doctor for the medical cure, but there may be other treatments that are needed that are not necessarily medical in the sense of drugs or surgery.
Well, and I think what this whole discussion is sort of realizing, or what we're coming to, is that there's a heck of a lot of gray area in this type of discussion. Because, I mean, yeah, there's problems where the patient isn't necessarily going to know what is best for them, and I don't think anyone's suggesting that sort of patient-based medicine should be the patient being allowed to borrow the doctor's prescription pad. But there are other cases where an intervention might actually cause side effects, harm, have different problems, where if a placebo did provide the same kind of subjective effects, it might actually cause less harm and do more good for the patient's well-being in the long run. But there are the ethical issues around that as far as the truthfulness to the patient. And speaking of alternative medicine, it's sort of an interesting point that this study itself was actually funded by the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine.
Aha!
But the conclusions that are written up by the authors are that objective scientific measurements should be the basis of what we're using. I should also note that several of the authors are receiving funding from Big Pharma. And this might seem like some strange dichotomy right away, but I'd like to... one of the reasons that I found this study so interesting, and especially right now, is that the placebo effect, really centering around a lot of the issues that we've been discussing here today, is under study in and of itself right now because of the problematic issues of using placebos in clinical trials due to either physiological or psychological placebo effects. And so this effect that has been recognized but understudied for so long is suddenly being studied in and of itself for both value in developing drugs and being able to use them more effectively to have drug development go smoother, as well as possible therapeutics in and of themselves.
Well, just understanding how the placebo effect even works. I mean, we're still pretty in the gray area on that as well, aren't we?
Absolutely. And I think the fact that, you know, they say if you want to know the truth, follow the money. And I think the fact that this study is indirectly being funded by both alternative medicine and Big Pharma can tell us just how gray this area is.
Mm-hmm. Which leads us to maybe a side topic, and you're kind of hinting upon this, and maybe affects the idea of the placebo, is our ability to trust. I mean, one of the things you were kind of pointing out there, that if you can't trust your doctor to be giving you real medicine because he may think that you're just all in your head or more in your head, and therefore you should just get a fake medicine, leads to a huge, I don't know, trust issue, which of course leads us to sit there and say, well, is the study itself trustworthy because who's funding it? And in this case, you're pointing out, I don't know who to trust because it's funded by both sides in an indirect way. In an odd sort of tangent to help fill up just the last minute of our time.
Which we have so much trouble with.
Yeah. Well, no, Doctors Without Borders issued a big complaint recently because As people may not know, Osama bin Laden was killed recently.
He was?
And one of the ways, apparently, that they tracked down where he was is that the American spy agencies, whichever one, CIA, what have you, had co-opted a vaccination program in that particular local district where they would go out and they would offer vaccination to children. And what they really were doing were collecting blood samples where they would do DNA testing to identify, is this really the place we want to get to or not? The Doctors Without Borders is sitting there saying this was a horrible thing for the American government to do because vaccinations have already suffered a lot of bad press or whatever, that this is somehow a Western plot to do something bad to the people of the Muslim world or African world or what have you, and that this just is played right into it. And this, again, this whole idea of trust and trust in scientists, trust in doctors is maybe it's a good topic for us to do sometime in the future.
Medical confidence.
Absolutely. Let's take one final commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back with our skeptical highlights. Stay tuned.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio. Happy. Boing.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. Let's go to our skeptical highlights.
I have an evolving highlight. Apparently, evolution and Stanley Park. Apparently, they go together. This Sunday, July 24th, between 1:30 and 3:30, there's going to be a walk in Stanley Park to explore evolution at work. Evolution plays a key role in what you see around you. The mutations and deviances it creates shapes who we are and what we might see. Science instructor Maria Moreland is going to have a fascinating walk through Stanley Park and its evolutionary history. I thought people might like to be involved in that. If you're a member of the Stanley Park Society, it's $5. If not, it's $10 to take part. More details will be available on our website. Speaking of birthdays,
I don't know anyone in this room whose birthday it is.
It's not my birthday.
Must be that guy who's sitting over there.
I have a skeptical highlight, which also is a caustic highlight. So it's the caustic soda tuberculosis episode hit the floor yesterday, and it's the latest episode of Caustic Soda, and it features your favorite Radio Free Thinker microbiologist chatting with the guys about the gruesome past and cryptic present of tuberculosis. So if you haven't listened to this podcast before, you should really check it out. It's hilariously macabre and educational to boot. So you can check that out, the tuberculosis episode, and other episodes on iTunes or at causticsodapodcast.com.
And I want to give Jenna a good clap for infecting yet another podcast with Radio Free Thinkers.
Oh, yes. That's my job, infection.
Yeah. Well, it is, actually, isn't it?
Very tuberculosis-y.
Yeah, tuberculosis-y.
Well, I have no skeptical highlights because I just got back from Tam.
Yay.
And I got to kill some ants.
Yes. And you had a birthday.
Yeah. But that's really no one's business but my own.
No. Except for Facebook. My God, there are so many. Anyhow.
Yeah, I have friends on Facebook. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening. Please tune in the future. We're going to have some great interviews. Really proud of them. You're going to like it.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna saying remember, the real world is amazing.
Thanks, Jenna.